And we have a bit of a provocative discussion coming up today because it's about climate change. The most recent news on climate change is sobering. It's not just about projections anymore. A big study released earlier this year indicates we're seeing the effects of climate change already. And even the most optimistic people have to admit the effects will be felt for a while longer, even if we figured out a way to stop the process of global warming today. Today's guest co-wrote a book that imagines how the future will look back on our time, how our decisions will be viewed nearly 400 years in the future. The book is called The Collapse of Western Civilization. It's co-written by Eric M. Conway and Naomi Oreskes. Eric M. Conway is our guest. He's a historian of science at the California Institute of Technology. Much of his work has focused on NASA's work on climate change, and he's won awards for it, including an award for his fourth book, Atmospheric Science at NASA, A History. Eric Conway, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a really interesting blend of history and science fiction. How did you and Naomi develop the idea?
Well, we were offered the opportunity to write an essay for a journal called Daedalus. This is now, 3 years ago, probably. And around about the time we'd been talking up our previous book, Merchants of Doubt, constantly, and we were offered the opportunity to tell the same story, and we didn't want to. So we conceived a way of making the same point in a different medium. In hopes of kind of sharpening them and maybe reaching a new audience. And so we published we've been struggling to figure out what genre we belong into, but this science-based fiction on the future of Western civilization.
Well, this process is very different then from doing a history of science in the sense that you're doing the same sort of process, but imagining what it'll be like nearly 400 years in the future. Did it take you both a while to get comfortable with the concept?
It took us a while to get comfortable with the idea of the use of fiction, yeah. And of course, the book is a blend of both what has already happened and thus history. Everything before 2014 is true, or rather, everything before 2013 is true, and everything after that is a science-based projection. But of course, we also had the help of a lot of predictive literature that exists in the scientific journals to help us along. So it took a bit of work to understand what we were doing and to figure out how to go about fictionalizing the story. Yeah, it was interesting.
So give us the framework. When is the narrative voice set, and what made you choose this particular time in future history?
It's set in 2393, the tercentennial of what the Chinese scholars in this essay have decided to call the collapse of Western civilization. Why did we pick that far in the future? Well, we wanted to get past the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is kind of the famous authority on the science of climate, but they only run their climate models for 100 years. But the CO2 we're putting in now will stay in the atmosphere, depending on whose estimate you use, between 600 and 1,000 years. So it will continue to affect civilization for that long. So we picked a point far enough in the future so that we could help our readers understand what that future world will look like when our CO2 has had a very long time to change the shape of the world. And in particular, as we focused on the melting of the ice sheets, that's a slow process. It won't happen overnight, but it sure looks like it's going to happen. And we wanted to communicate that point to our readers very clearly. And the 300 years in the future seemed a good way to do it, almost 400.
Did you have to do some revising of some of your estimates as you went along the way? Because it seems like there's always a fair amount of tweaking about things like, oh, no, wait, now we think the sea levels are going to rise by this much more, that sort of thing. In other words, could the future be even worse than what you're predicting in this book?
Good Lord, I hope it's not worse, because we took the scenario as an inspiration from a glaciologist, a very famous glaciologist of Ohio State University by the name of John Mercer, who made a forecast in the mid-1970s about the melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is about 6 meters worth of sea level by itself. And even then, he was making a fairly catastrophic forecast of over the next 400 or 500 years, the complete disintegration of that ice sheet. And that was, he was only talking about that one. And of course, Greenland is also vulnerable. Plus there's thermal expansion and so on. So we started out with what is a pretty high end estimate. It's quite a bit higher than the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is, again, for example. but they have also got a track record now of being systematically low in their sea level rise predictions. So I'm quite sure we'll be accused of being alarmist. It's already happening. But the reality is we picked a very scientifically sound position from the 1970s to use. So to very answer your question very specifically, did we have to go through endless constant revisions because the scientists are? No, we didn't. We started much further in the past than most of them have.
There's a couple of quotes in here that I guess by themselves are not that chilling, but when you take just look at the words here, knowledge did not translate to power for the people of our time. What does that mean?
There's this idea of, in history of science, of extending from Francis Bacon, that once you understand a problem, that knowledge becomes a form of power because it gives you an approach to solving that problem. And that's what's not happening in the climate change realm. We understand the problem quite well. We've known for decades what we have to do about it. And to date, none of the Western countries, except possibly Germany, have really taken the kinds of action necessary to translate that knowledge into action.
Eric M. Conway is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book he co-wrote with Naomi Oreskes is The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, almost 400 years in the future. We can talk more, and we'll talk more about the views of what will happen to the world ahead of us if we continue to do what we're doing now. Back with Eric Conway and your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is historian of science Eric Conway. He and fellow historian of science Naomi Oreskes wrote a book called The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. It is largely about climate change. It imagines how a historian of science writing in the year 2393 would look back at our time, nearly 400 years in the past, and the decisions we made or didn't make that affected what had happened to the planet in the years and decades afterward. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. When you consider, though, Eric Conway, I have to compliment you and Naomi Oreskes on the fact that you don't give too many details about the future. We don't hear about flying cars or, you know, spaghetti-powered machines or anything like that. But in the same token, though, you're looking back at our time. And I know when we look back just 200 years, for example, in the science of medicine and think about leeches and bleeding and things that went on back then, so much has changed. Do you not see, is there no optimistic strain in either of you to think about, hey, you know, we might be able to conquer our problems if we figure out something really great within the next 50 years or so?
Oh, I think that's actually the opposite of the truth. Naomi and I talk about this a lot. We actually believe that solving the climate problem is actually pretty easy, precisely because if you look back only 50 or 60 years at the energy infrastructure of the United States, it's changed dramatically just in that period of time. The climate change deniers like to harp on this idea that, well, we can't do it, so we shouldn't, because it's too hard or it's too expensive or whatever, and we think that's nonsense. The reality is that changing the complete infrastructure of the United States has happened before in a space of only 50 or 60 years, and we can do it again. But we have to choose to do it, and what collapse is about is our refusal to do it. It's not that we don't think that we're capable of it. Naomi and I do think we're capable of it. We're just refusing to do it.
When you talk about us changing our infrastructure drastically already, you're talking about the change from horses to cars or something like that?
Well, we've changed from horses to cars. If you think back a little further, we went from canals to horses. We also had a period in which railroads were completely dominant prior to the motor car. Then there's a whole aviation infrastructure that didn't exist 80 years ago. Electrical distribution it's a little more complicated there because it's for about the first 40 years of electricity. It spreads throughout the cities very quickly, but never gets to the countryside, and it takes government intervention to get it to the countryside over the next 30 years. But the reality is all those things were done in the spaces between 50 and 80 years. and the speed, which has a lot to do with incentives available from local, state, and federal governments. But that's our point. If we need to change the energy infrastructure of the United States for climate change, and we think we do, we know we can do it because we've done it before. We're just refusing to take the steps that we need to in order to bring that about. And it's that refusal that the collapse of Western civilization is about.
One of the things you point out in the book, and again, everything before 2013 is fact, and everything after that time is conjecture. But you say that early information on climate change came from military activities.
Oh yes. Well, there's a long history to climate science. A lot of the early climate science in the 19th century was pure interest in how the world works. But during the early 20th century, a lot of the work on in basic understanding of climate came from things like the Air Force wanting better guided missiles. They needed to understand energy transmission through the atmosphere better. So they spent enormous amounts of time measuring the way infrared radiation moves through the atmosphere so they can make better heat seekers for anti-aircraft missiles, for example. And it's still the Air Force that maintains that radiative transfer database, and climate modelers use it. Another aspect of it is wind modeling for the distribution of nuclear fallout. And so the military spent a lot of money improving atmospheric circulation models for that purpose. And atmospheric circulation models are one of the bases of climate models. So, yeah, a lot of military work went into understanding the basic physics of climate.
We're talking to Eric Conway about the book he co-wrote with Naomi Oreskes called The Collapse of Western Civilization here on the Jefferson Exchange. Ann and Eugene is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Conway.
Thank you. Peter DeFazio is going to be appearing here in Eugene at Peterson Barn this afternoon at 1:30, and I'm going to go to that meeting. And if I get a chance to ask a question, here's the question I'm going to ask. Why do politicians think that we can have infinite material growth on a finite planet? I'd like to hear the comment from your author. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that, Ann. Appreciate it. Congressman DeFazio, of course, representing the Oregon 4th District, which is a large part of our viewing area, a listening area. Eric Conway, your thoughts about politicians and well, not more than politicians, but the general view that we can continue to grow economically and yet our resources are finite.
Yeah, I honestly don't know the answer to that either. If you can conceive growth in a way that is not a material growth, then it's possible. But I kind of agree with the caller that I also can't imagine a future in which one can have infinite material growth unless one does what some of the hardcore space enthusiasts call for, colonizing the solar system, and then you have still not quite infinite resources, but certainly much greater resources. But I would also warn those folks that the principal problem with that idea is that it doesn't fix the our overwhelming of the resource use sinks in the world. For example, we have these increasing ocean dead zones caused by agricultural runoff, and that problem of overwhelming the planetary sinks isn't solved by bringing in space resources. But yeah, I can't conceive a future of infinite growth either. And so part of the argument we make in Collapse is that basic conception needs to be rethought and reworked into a more sustainable form.
Collapse of Western Civilization, or CWC. I noticed that you call the book sometimes in your own shorthand. The book does include footnotes. I mean, it's supposedly written in 2393, but includes footnotes. First is on the Anthropocene, and we've talked about this a bit on the program. What is the Anthropocene period, and why is there still some debate about formalizing that term?
The Anthropocene is the time period in which the human fingerprint on the world becomes obvious, and we start to overwhelm natural processes. And I think the debate I'm familiar with is actually really one of when did it start? There's actually an argument that's got some good evidence, though it's quite controversial, that we should actually push the boundaries back to something around 7,000 or 10,000 years, because that's when there seems to be some evidence of which deforestation starts showing up in the atmospheric record in a pretty significant way. But that's the debate I'm familiar with.
Your future narrators in the book, The Collapse of Western Civilization, refer to the penumbral period. And what is that?
The penumbral period is the period in which we stop relying on evidence from science and reasoned approach to evidence in our policymaking in favor of the arguments of vested interests, the fossil fuel interests, and so on. The idea being that shadow of doubt and disinformation descends on the West, and we stop governing ourselves in accordance with the knowledge that our scientists have.
Well, you're a historian of science then. I mean, you and Naomi must have looked to see if there were similar sorts of backlashes against the prevailing science, in this case, the prevailing science of, yes, the Earth is changing. We're getting warmer. There's more carbon in the atmosphere. Is there anything on this scale that compares in history?
I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I kind of sense two questions. In our previous book, Merchants of Doubt, we addressed other cases in which science was challenged by industry in order to sustain their own profits. Tobacco was a big part of that book, and so is acid rain. So there have been other cases besides climate change in which industries have challenged quite successfully in the court of public opinion over decades what the scientific findings were. So if that's not the answer to the question you were looking for, maybe rephrase the question.
No, you got it right. I mean, I was looking for an example of where there'd been as much of a concerted effort to drown science essentially as has happened with climate change, and the answer is yes.
Yeah, the tobacco industry launched out on this path long before, and they were the source of many of the techniques being used against climate change now.
Eric M. Conway is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, science historian of science at the California Institute of Technology. He co-wrote with Naomi Oreskes the book The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. It is a look from a couple of historians of science in the year 2393, looking back to our time and the things we did and did not do to address climate change. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Jim in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Yes, you remember not too long ago I asked kind of this question. I said, when will science, which is predominantly a male system, take responsibility and say we are responsible for the thousands of extinctions in the past? Does your gentleman see a sociological shift where women who usually work in groups but respect each other for progress for themselves, for their families, rather than just take? Example, they always comes up about tobacco. Remember, people came to this land, men, and took the land from the natives, using it in the way they felt the Creator had meant for them to use it. Planted tobacco, cotton, different things that robbed the soil, so the soil was no good because they didn't understand companion planting. You know, it's just a never-ending take, but it was 99% men projecting that. And I don't see any great change until there's a sociological shift of women taking control.
All right. Thanks for that, Jim. Appreciate it. Your thoughts, Eric?
You sort of wanted to blame scientists for this, and I have to say that I think that it's a much broader problem than that. Certainly women are substantially underrepresented in sciences, and especially the physical sciences that I study, and I hope that that will change over the generations. There certainly have been plenty of efforts to do it, and though often undermined by much more mundane things like labor policies and tenure policies and so on. But would that solve our problem, merely giving women more power? I don't think so, because as long as we're enthralled to an economic ideology of unfettered growth and via a particular form of free markets, I don't think we have a solve the problem of climate change anyway. It can be solved.
There's an interesting viewpoint in the collapse of Western civilization, though, where the scientists of the future narrators from the 24th century are calling it archaic that scientists in our time worked in isolation from social systems. So what should we be doing in sciences that we're not?
One of the challenges of the modern scientific community has, we think, is that it has become so professionalized that it is no longer really an active participation in normal society. If you look back a couple of hundred years, it was very common for scientists, even very high-profile scientists, to write popular books, to give popular lectures. Those things were simply considered part of the function of being a, and I use the word deliberately with a little warning too, of being a man of science, because there weren't any women. But that is a kind of thing that Naomi and I think needs to come back. We need to see scientists participating more actively again in writing popular books, in giving popular lectures, in making their knowledge more widely available. And right now there are no incentives for the scientific community to do that, and quite the opposite in a lot of ways. There's fear that your tenure committee won't appreciate or approve of public outreach work you've done. There's no funding, by and large, with a couple of the small exceptions, for doing outreach work as a scientist, et cetera. So popular participation is now kind of frowned upon by the scientific community, and that's what we think has to change.
Eric Conway is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He and Naomi Oreskes wrote The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. You talk about scientists working in a more popular realm then and communicating their ideas. I mean, this book is not a very big one. It's quite easy to get through. I mean, the epilogue completes on page 52, and then you move off into a lexicon of archaic terms. So was this meant to be in the vein you were just talking about, something that's more accessible to a non-science kind of audience?
That's what we were hoping to achieve. It'll be up to your audience, though, to tell us whether we succeeded.
Right. Let's take a call. Here's Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric M. Conway.
Hi. I wanted to compliment you on your title. It's a very compelling post-apocalyptic scare, but I think that's a lot of it. It was in some ways a scare. What is the one tool that mankind has had since the beginning of time to deal with climate change? And realize that climate has always been changing since man was first arrived on the planet 3 million years ago in Africa, and that's migration, okay? And I think animals and even humans in a very hot climate will probably immigrate away from the equator and towards the poles, towards the north and the south poles, depending on which hemisphere you are in. And I think part of how mankind can deal with this is by migration. I think Americans would look more towards Canada, and Europeans would look more towards the Scandinavian countries to kind of find a tolerable climate. And people will move out of the Mideast, they'll move out of the equator, they'll move out of Africa, Central Africa and Sub-Saharan Africa. It'd be it won't be able to support life because it's 120 degrees. Okay, but at the same time, unless we find a way to control the weather, a weather machine, we're going to deal with this the same way as our ancestors did 1 million years ago, and that's by walking, by migrating, by moving. And I see us more like, those Gulf Stream, Airstream RV parks. They're just going to be moving further and further north towards, the Canadian tundra and the Russian tundra and Scandinavia.
All right, so we'll just take off.
Ironically, we might find a new continent to populate, and that'd be Antarctica, because it might actually get cool enough or warm enough for people to actually settle. Right now, there's maybe 200 people living there. Imagine if there was a city that had 1 million people there in Antarctica in the next 100 years. And I also want to point out that people think we're going
I need to get into, because we can get an answer here before we get to a break. So thanks for the call, Jacob. Appreciate it. So what are you thinking about what you're hearing, Eric Conway?
Three problems with this approach. First is that nation states don't allow unlimited migration. The best evidence you can have is the fact that the United States spent $6 billion building a wall across the Mexican border because we don't want them here. or at least a large fraction of our politics doesn't want them here. Second problem with it is agriculture doesn't move quite so easily anymore. We can't, for example, simply reproduce Midwestern industrial agriculture in the U.S. up in northern Canada because the soil's not the same. It's thin, rocky forest soils up there, and that's why my ancestors gave up farming in New England. Third problem is that none of that deals with the ocean acidification, which is not a normal process of climate change, but is one fueled entirely by anthropogenic use, and that will slowly damage the ocean ecosystems that feed an enormous fraction of the world population.
Much more to talk about with Eric Conway. His book with Naomi Oreskes is The Collapse of Western Civilization, back on the Jefferson Exchange with our co-author and your questions and comments when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is historian of science at Caltech, Eric M. Conway. He and Naomi Oreskes, a fellow historian of science, teamed up on the book The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future, in which historians of science in the year 2393 look back at what went wrong in our time, the beginning of what we're calling the penumbral period in the book. Join us as we talk about the Earth's fate, grim though it might be, if we don't change things. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. One of our callers wants to know, Eric, if you have read much or any of Oswald Spengler's work, the Downfall of the Occident.
Oh, no, sorry, I'm not familiar with that at all.
Okay, enough on Mr. Spengler. Let's go to Sandy in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Conway.
Yeah, hi, Jeffrey. Another great program. Well, Eric, I felt like you kind of blew off, I think it was Grumpy John's comment about women, if we had more women in power, a little too early. I think that...
GM, actually.
If we had more... I think if we had more women in power, it would make a significant difference, because my observation is that we're inclined to cooperation. I think that the reason that we don't have more women in power is partly because historically women have been so relegated to the back seat of big events and power and such that they don't quite know how to assert themselves in the way, and there's been so much obstruction to their asserting themselves. But I think if we had more women in power, it would make a huge difference, because they would recognize much more quickly the insanity of some of the practices we're currently engaged in. I did agree with your if we don't, you know, get rid of the idea that we can have everything, you know, at no cost, of course nothing will change, but I think it would make a huge difference.
All right. Thanks.
Anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
All right. Thanks for that, Sandy. Appreciate it. You don't get too much into what becomes of politics and political structures, other than to say that the United States becomes replaced by the United States of North America?
Yes. Essentially, it's a merger with Canada. And yet, you're quite right. We don't say very much about the government structure that results from that. Because we were writing from the perspective of the Second People's Republic of China, we didn't really explore what winds up happening to the former democracies of either North America or of what's left of Europe.
So is China then the superpower at this point in history, you see, in the 24th century, almost the 25th?
Well, such as it is, we don't use that term because that world, the world we're conceiving in the future, is one that doesn't have the same sorts of massive military investments, because they had to divert resources into salvaging themselves and their economies and their populations from the rapid changes in the climate. So there's nothing akin in that world 400 years in the future to the United States now.
Well, and you do single out China in our time, or at least slightly ahead of our time, to borrow Panasonic's old expression, for doing some things right. But, you know, people could look at China's air today and go, oh, my God, what are they doing over there? Sure, burning a lot of coal still and oil and everything else as their economy expands by leaps and bounds. But do you see China, both of you, as doing something right now that will lead to results down the road?
That's not actually not why we picked China at all. When we were writing Merchants of Doubt, one of the things we discovered was that our actors, the folks who decided very, very early on to oppose any kind of climate action, was that they believed that climate change, dealing with climate change, was just a route to bringing socialism into the United States, and making the United States a communist country. And that's really what they were afraid of. So because they set out in a path to block us from using even the market-friendly kinds of environmental remedies that were being proposed by some of their own allies back in the 1980s, the idea of emissions trading, of carbon taxes, of that kind of thing, we decided to tell the story from the future survivor of the collapse of Western civilization, the People's Republic of China, not because we think that they're better positioned, but for the narrative purpose of reflecting the fears of those actors of the 1980s back at them. They bring about the rise of authoritarian regimes in our argument because they prevented the Western countries from using the more capitalist-friendly economic tools and environmental tools that were available to them at the time, leaving only the authoritarian governments to finally deal with the crisis in a very dramatic and not very humane ways.
Now, obviously there are jumps back and forth between what you see happening in the future and the way the future looks back at our time. And as you point out, everything up to 2013 is stuff that really happened. So people might not be familiar with North Carolina's sea level rise denial bill. What was that?
Well, that wasn't its name. We gave it because it never had a name other than a bill number.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of the law was to prevent scientists in North Carolina who were preparing policy papers on coastal development and so forth from using the results of climate models to forecast sea level rise. Instead, they're only allowed to use extrapolations back to the past increases in sea level. And the problem with that is that the climate models incorporate a much more rapid sea level rise forced by carbon dioxide in the atmosphere because it making the atmosphere warmer makes the oceans warmer, and so the seawater expands more rapidly. So instead of getting a linear sea level rise, you get a more exponential one. And by passing that law, what North Carolina did was cripple itself in the face of climate change. They made themselves less able to deal with that aspect of climate change.
I'm curious about the kinds of reactions that you and Naomi have just at you know, daily news at stuff like this. I mean, there are times you end up just smacking your hand against your head thinking, oh, my God. Are you a little more patient than that as a historian of science?
I comment in the questions and answer things that sometimes I think the denialists are in league with the yes men because they're just so bizarrely funny. But I guess in doing the kind of work we've done, and we've been doing this now for about 10 years, you really have to develop a good sense of humor to deal with the silliness and absurdity of some of the politics and the statements you get out of politicians about climate change and so on. It shouldn't be funny, but sometimes it really is.
Right. You're particularly harsh on what you call the, from the future, of course, the deadly expansion of fossil fuel production with a particular emphasis on the current drilling boom. And it brings us to the use of the term fugitive emissions. What are those? What happens?
Well, fugitive emissions are all of those emissions that don't lead to us burning the stuff as a fuel. So leaking pipelines, leaking tanks. Wellheads that leak, flaring when they burn off excess gas, all those kinds of things are fugitive emissions. And because they're not planned, they're also not well measured, and they're also, and they're generally not considered in policy as well. So there's an argument that natural gas is cleaner and has lower emissions from the use of that fuel than coal does. But that's only the case if you don't consider all these other fugitive emissions. It's not so clear that that's true once you do. And that's our point.
There is a scenario in the book. I mean, obviously some key moments in history between our time and the time from which your imagined authors write. Huge heat waves and crop failures in the year 2041. I mean, I imagine this is all constructed on things you believe could happen without action in the not-too-distant future.
Well, of course, some of them have happened already, right? We had this huge heat wave in France a few years ago that resulted in a lot of deaths. We have routine droughts. We're having a bad one in California now, and the only reason we're not having massive crop failures is we're groundwater mining to salvage the situation until there's enough rainfall to refill our reservoirs. So these things have happened in the past, and as historians, we're pretty convinced that things that happened in the past can happen in the future. The difference is that they'll happen more often in the future under the rapid warming that the climate scientists say is coming.
Now, attempts to engineer the climate, this has been talked about, you know, ways to aerosolize things or create something like the nuclear winter scenario. I mean, are these being taken seriously at all in our time, and do you see them being taken more seriously as things get worse?
There are some scientists lots of scientists take them seriously as research topics, and rightly so. There should be research to try to understand the effects of those things. There are some scientists who are afraid enough of climate change to also be starting to think seriously about them as policy. And part of our writing of that section of the book was as a warning, because the consequences of doing something like solar radiation management, of literally throwing aerosol particles up into the atmosphere for centuries, first off, has all kinds of unknown consequences, and second, doesn't, of course, solve the ocean acidification problem that really, I think, has gotten a lot less attention than it should, including from us. It's not in our book and perhaps should have been, but it's frightening for us to contemplate, but to answer the question, yeah, lots of people are thinking seriously about it, but I hope, crossing my fingers here, they're not planning to do it in any serious way.
I don't want to give away too many details in the book, do you hold out hope for new technology coming along to save us, or do you think the means are within our grasp now?
Well, I think the means are within our grasp already, but I also have to say that the means are largely policy tools. The way one fosters new technologies is to create incentives for entrepreneurs, inventors, even large corporations to invest in those technologies. So, to take a modern example that hasn't gotten much really serious historical attention yet. You know, we used to have one phone company up until the Reagan administration broke up AT&T, and then we got a whole bunch of baby bells. And on top of that, we had the early cell phone startups who saw an opportunity in this destruction of Ma Bell to finally be able to bring a new technology into the market. In other words, the government created incentives to bring that new technology to some new kind of form. And that's what we mean as the way forward. It's not just about new technology. It's not just about Silicon Valley innovation, though we need that. But you also have to have policy incentives to actually make it possible to bring them to those technologies to market and really distribute them widely. It's not enough to have stuff come out of the laboratory. It actually has to get into people's hands. And that's where policy plays a big, big role.
But do policy incentives end up becoming economic incentives? I mean, does it have to be worth somebody? I mean, does somebody have to make a buck at this to be able? Does somebody have to make a buck at saving the planet to be worth saving the planet?
Well, yeah. So policy translates into economics. Well, that's why companies have so many lobbyists. But to be blunt about it, in our system, that's the way that it works. You have to create policy incentives. Those policy incentives make it possible for someone to make money in order to bring these solutions to fruition. So policy and economics go hand in glove, absolutely, and technology helps to follow.
Although I noticed that there are some comments on economics in the book, in the glossary section, which is a good chunk of the back of the book, the invisible hand is described as a form of magical thinking. You and Naomi had some fun writing this book, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, especially the lexicon of archaic terms. Yeah, it's kind of reimagining the way people will think about our ideas 400 years in the future was a fun exercise.
And where do you see it leading? I mean, are you having much of a reaction to the book just yet?
It's hard for us to know. It's kind of too soon, especially being August, right? It comes out in July, and then everybody goes on vacation for a month. So we'll expect to get more responses in September, I think.
Yeah, when people come back to work, for sure. Most of the publishing industry seems to take the month of August off, too.
Yeah.
Right. But you've certainly given us a lot to think about here. And
I hope so.
Is it as gloomy as the book would portray it to be, in your own mind?
No. As I said, to me, and the question is an answer, as I talk a little bit about this, you know, to me, it's all about trying to create a situation in which you can get positive movement. One of your callers said this is just a scare tactic, but it's not intended as that. It's intended to be a warning as the way things could be if we don't do anything in the present. But it's not intended to say, well, we shouldn't do anything. It's not intended to be disempowering. It's intended to cause people to go out, think, and work for a better future.
The book is called The Collapse of Western Civilization, A View from the Future. It is set in 2393, looking back at our time. Eric Conway and Naomi Oreskes wrote it. Thanks so much for joining us today, Eric.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you. And that'll do it for today's exchange. Tomorrow at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about overpasses for wildlife. We'll talk at 8:30 about the Oregon Health Plan adding some transgender procedures. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll spend the hour talking about death and our reactions to death with a hospice nurse who spent a lot of time trying to change people's attitudes about death. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duren. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks so much for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on JPR. And have a great day.